welcome everybody. This is week 7. Or is it week 8? It is week 7. Just checking, just testing. Testing everybody's memory. Okay, this is the announcement that I put up earlier. I don't know how many of you read it. How many of you have read this announcement? Okay. Joan and Derek have read it. I'm going to read it out to you because there are important things that need to sink in. Week 7 is upon us, and I hope you can all make it to class today. Well, welcome. You've all made it to class today. The assignment box for your essay is up and running. So simply post your assignment into that box. If you click here, I've made a link. So if you click here, it will take you straight to the box. Okay, your box is different to mine because I'm the teacher and you're the student. You will have a box there. But you can also find it at the bottom of the top module in Leo, down to where it says assignments. I have made a comment on nearly everyone's most recent blog, so check this out. You're all working really well in this medium. I will show you today what some of my on-campus students are doing in this medium. I'll just spend a couple of minutes doing that. Today we are going to explore a couple of stories by Henry Lawson as the last stage of study of what makes the genre of prose different from poetry. Henry Lawson is a really special case because in a way he created the Australian idiom through his selection of working class language for his stories and prose journalism. We will look at a piece of journalism written while he was travelling the New South Wales countryside, and we will look at his story Drifted Back. You'll be amazed by how much Lawson seems to be able to get into his stories despite the brevity. He is a master of suggestion. That means he doesn't say everything that he wants to. There's more behind his words, as in all great writers, but this is a particular, he has a particular quality. G'day, Tom. Glad you're here. That's all right. That's all right. We will also watch a filmed version of Drifted Back to help us begin thinking about what makes the difference between prose and drama. Now, this is an important bit that needs to sink in. Next week, we are heading to the State Library of New South Wales, and you'll notice that I've put a link there. So if you click on there, it'll give you directions how to get there. To look at Shakespeare's room, and we're also going to the New South Wales Art Gallery to think about how the visual arts can really expand our view of what literature is all about. Check out the links for how to get there. We will meet you all at the entrance to the State Library, facing out to Macquarie Street at around 10 to 2. Now, Francis has just told me, not Francis, yeah, it is Francis, sorry. Francis has just told me that she's going to leave here at 1:30 next week and walk down to the State Library. So if you want to meet with her here at 1:30, you can all walk down to the State Library. But if you want to go on your own steam, then the State Library faces Macquarie Street, the main entrance, and we're going in there to have a look at the Shakespeare Room, because the following week we're starting our four-week module on Shakespeare's As You Like It in preparation for our performance. And we're going across to the New South Wales Art Gallery after we've been to the Shakespeare Room to think about the relationship between literature and the visual arts. So, and it says the following week we are starting our rehearsals for Shakespeare's As You Like It. So I handed those out a fortnight ago. If you can dig those out, bring them in a fortnight. I shall bring some spares if you've lost them. And we'll begin work on As You Like It, building on our watching of the John Bell performance. Any questions about any of that?
When we go to the, for that outing,
yep.
Can we, because if we go to the art gallery, it's yep. just across the botanical garden.
That's right.
And in the botanical garden, they actually have a mulberry tree that was taken from a cutting from Shakespeare's garden.
I know this. I know this.
Yeah, I think it's just nice.
That's interesting. Do you know where it is?
Yeah, I'll go and get my mulberries there all the time.
Well, you get your mulberries there. That's interesting.
Yeah.
Well, if it's not too far and if we
no,
have time.
Not, it's just that it's not even a five minutes walk from the art gallery.
I know. It's just that the library will finish probably about 3 and then the
yeah.
gallery finishes
well,
at 5.
It's just a suggestion.
It's a good suggestion. If
yeah.
we can do it, we'll do it.
Yeah.
Because in the Shakespeare room, they actually have a chair made out of that same mulberry tree.
Oh, my God.
The same tree.
Yes.
So, yeah. And the mulberry tree came from his garden.
Yes.
Yeah. So, just to have a little look. Sorry, Derek, go.
The assignment box, when you go to it, it says that it's already overdue.
Does it?
Yeah.
Okay, let me have a look.
They sent you out.
Let me have a look. Then there's something wrong with my settings. So I'll go into there. And I've got to go and turn editing on. Yeah. Now that's easy to fix if that's the problem. Edit settings. Allow some due date, 22nd of April. What's the date today?
22nd of April. It's set to 12 a.m. rather than 11 p.m.
Okay, that's good. So we'll set it to 23:55. Right, that's it. So you got until 11:55 tonight. Okay.
The train will be back on at 6.
They will. Okay. Just want to have a quick look here. As I say, I've commented on most people's blogs, but I just wanted to... Where is this? Where is the more recent blog for you, Mike? I don't know why this more recent one isn't coming up. Anyway, Michael, should be in your site, shouldn't it?
Should be.
Yeah.
You commented on it.
I commented on it, yeah. So I don't know why it's not there. You haven't...
Untouched it.
Haven't touched it. Let me have a look here.
Is there any difference between AR and WordPress?
Yes, there's a lot of difference. I tell you, I'm going to find it here. I'm pretty sure I'm going to find it here. Because this is where you've posted your URL. And that's your URL. Now, that's the same URL that I just logged into. So I don't understand why. That is weird. That is weird.
Did it come up now?
It came up. There it is.
Oh, gotcha.
So here is Michael's work in progress. We cannot reverse the sun, nor recount days past. All we do is embrace what is now and seek that which is before us. Live this moment and forget the past. Aspire to greater heights and believe. Even when faith is scarce and rare, true contentment stems from the solitude of self. Forge a new beginning and lay the foundations of tomorrow from the experiences of the past. Hope awaits those who reach and dare to dream. This existence is true, and destiny evolves with the choices we make today. True happiness will not be defined nor restrained with mere and simple words. This day is on loan. Time affords no luxuries, as life in kind will not return. Realize this truth and make reality all that resides in conscious thought. And I think that was a very, very interesting poem, looking at one's inner state and looking at what one needs to grow. And I made this sort of extensive revision of his poem, changing some words, changing stanzas, etc., which might be worth having a look at. So, all of you have been doing great blogs, but I don't want to spend today on that. I want to spend today on Henry Lawson's stories. And just before we do that, I thought I'd take you to have a look at what some of the students at uni, where you're all heading, have been doing. So I've just put up here, I've just had to mark 120 blogs from students.
Wow.
And the best ones are here. What I say is, my students are performing miracles with their blogs. They're grasping and extending the content of literature they're studying in the most creative ways, poems and prose creations, giving expression to their own experience. Along with this, they're producing digital resources for future study. So here's one, Jesse Benjamin, giving perspective. We're looking at Shakespeare's Golden Age, and then they're reviewing each other's work. This is a student whose work's been reviewed. We're doing Emily Bronte. This particular student is doing 19th century literature as well as Shakespeare. So they're doing pretty substantial blogs each week, and that's really extending. Here's one, is just, we went to the art gallery last week, and he's commenting on this painting here about New Zealand. He's saying, briefly describe your sense of the value of going to the art gallery of New South Wales as a literature student. That was the question I put to them. Did it seem a worthwhile activity? Did it enlarge your sense of what romantic literature is all about? Sorry, I've lost it. Where did it get to? I know this is making you dizzy, I'm very sorry. there it is. The value that is rooted within the art gallery for a literature student is immense. As you are already aware, when you read literature in any way, shape or form, your mind develops an image or stream of images in which you paint the picture you are reading. This stream of images rushes through your mind like a stop animation artwork, travelling at the speed of light to visually enable you to comprehend what the letter before you are saying. Yes, this is what the impact of words are to the human mind. You may be asking how, in a gallery filled to the brim with artworks, can artworks possibly do the opposite, or in any way help a literature student? The art gallery, in fact, can be one of the greatest assets for literary students, and this is how. No matter when or where an artist takes time to paint what they see or interpret in their own mind, there had to be an influence of the time. These artworks are snapshots of time frames and culture. These artists have been able to interpret what their minds were able to understand from their worlds. And this allows us to have a visual image which falls alongside with those men and women who wrote timeless literature. And then he wrote about this particular painting by Eugene von Gerard, painted in the 19th century. So that's just one of the students. Let's go back. But you can, if you visit my blog site, you can actually look at these yourself. Here's another student, welcome to the world of literature. And she's done reviews of other students' works. She's done one here, a topic was, in a paragraph, summarize the way in which the wristwatch controls our existence. Because I'm doing 19th century literature with them, and it was in the year 1853 that the wristwatch was invented. And 1853 was the time when all the writers were starting to complain about the way that time was getting faster and faster. And they all had wristwatches now, you see. So that was their major problem.
First world problem.
This is the problem with modern existence. People are not living freely and simply. The wristwatch is a symbol of this restricting and competitive society. The wristwatch controls our existence constantly as it is a symbol of people being pushed by time. Okay, So there's just a little glimpse of some of the writings of my students. Now, I've all got this handout. Did you all get a handout that has come around?
Yeah.
This one, Henry Lawson, Drifted Back. Everybody got that in front of them? We're going to start in the second page. There's a story called In a Dry Season. Have you got that? In a Dry Season. Sorry? Exactly. This is by your friend Henry Lawson, by the way, and he's writing very much about Leighton. Now, this is a very short story. It's only two pages in length, but it gives us a lot to talk about in terms of short story technique. And also, it gets us talking about the relationship between literature and painting, which is something we're going to do next week. And just an explanation of this image here for a moment. The second story we're going to look at in a moment is the story that's... I have a film to show you of it. And last week I was explaining to Michael the difference between poetry and prose. Well, this week we're starting to move from prose into drama. The difference is that drama is set out with speakers on the stage, but prose is like this. I mean, it's a very obvious distinction between drama and prose. Drama, he, howdy, she, what do you want? He, howdy, she, yeah, shut up. Okay, so that's the beginning of a play. A beginning of a play anybody could write. And this is the landscape we're going to be reading about right now with Henry Lawson. So, in a dry season, I'm sorry the print on this is so small. This is a kind of a standard edition of Henry Lawson's short stories, and they crammed all these stories into one volume and used rather small print. But I will read it and bring it to life for you. Lawson begins. This is actually not so much a story, this is a piece of journalism where he was describing the world around where he was travelling out back. Draw a wire fence and a few ragged gums. Now, he uses the word draw there as, you know, an artist. He's talking like an artist. So draw a wire fence and a few gums, like that. Draw a wire fence and a few ragged gums. And add some scattered sheep running away from the train. So here's a few sheep running away from the train. There's the train track. Henry Lawson was very conscious of the train track because train tracks meant the end of an era. It meant the end of the bullocky. The train track was beginning due to the jobs of the bullock drivers. And add some scattered sheep running away from the train. Then you'll have the bush all along the New South Wales western line from Bathurst on. So that's what the bush is. All it is, a wire fence with a few ragged gums, and a few scattered sheep running away from the train line. That's a paragraph. And it's like a very minimalist. I've used that word before. Minimalist. He uses very few words, and yet through the few words he really creates a picture of the kind of blank world that the bush is. Draw a wire fence and a few ragged gums and add some scattered sheep running away from the train. Then you'll have the bush all along the New South Wales western line from Bathurst on. And it's sort of tongue-in-cheek, it's kind of comic. It's sort of making a statement about what the bush is. People think the bush is a wonderful place, full of great plains and sunlit expanses and beautiful trees. Lawson has got a very different picture. Next paragraph. The railway towns consist of a public house and a general store, with a square tank and a schoolhouse on piles in the nearer distance. The tank stands at the end of the school and is not many times smaller than the building itself. It is safe to call the pub the Railway Hotel, and the store the Railway Stores, with an S. A couple of patient, ungroomed hacks are probably standing outside the pub while their masters are inside having a drink. Several drinks. Also, it's safe to draw a sundowner sitting listlessly on a bench on the veranda reading the bulletin. What's a sundowner? Somebody who turns up late at the end of the day and wants a bed and wants a fee, but he doesn't turn up early enough to do any work. So that's what a sundowner is.
What's a hack?
What's a hack?
Yeah.
Where is the hack?
Outside the pub.
Oh, ungroomed hacks.
Yeah.
A couple of patient, ungroomed hacks. People who look after
their
horses.
Their masters inside.
No, the hack is actually the horse.
Yeah. Is it the horse? A couple of patient, ungroomed hacks.
Yeah.
It's actually the horse. You're right.
Because it says the master back in the pub.
That's it. That's
line.
It.
It's just standing there.
Yeah, yeah.
It hasn't even been cleaned up properly.
Yeah.
Opposite of Thoroughbridge.
Why does he say it's...
I haven't got the thing.
You haven't got the text?
No, I'm reading the Bible.
It's on. You've got them there. Okay.
Good.
I didn't think
it's short for
why do you think he says it's safe to call the pub the railway hotel? It's safe to call the pub the railway
hotel. If you're an outsider coming from far away, he's telling you as a matter of sort of like just a bit of local knowledge. It's okay if you call it the railway hotel. You won't get yourself into an argument.
Because they've all got a railway hotel. It's sort of a stereotypical outback town. They're all the same, more or less. That's what he's implying.
This minimalness.
They're what, sorry, Tom?
They're a pub and a store and not much more.
They're a pub and a store and not much more. Let's read the... Yeah, Mike?
This style is really effective, I remember. What he's saying. How do you remember?
You actually remember what he's saying.
Yeah,
it's,
I don't get lost in the passage.
That's right, that's right.
And it does help if Michael's reading it, if you shut your eyes, you can actually picture it, the light in anyway.
That's it. So the next paragraph. The railway stores seem to exist only in the shadow of the pub, and it is impossible to conceive either as being independent of the other. So the railway store and the pub, they are connected. There is sometimes a small oblong weatherboard building, unpainted and generally leaning in one of the eight possible directions, and perhaps with a twist in another, which from its half-obliterated sign seems to have started as a rival to the railway stores, but the shutters are up and the place empty. So there's this weatherboard building that could be leaning in one of eight possible directions. You know, you can think of a building that's about to fall over. It could be leaning this way or this way or this way. And as well as that, it's got a twist in the middle of it. So how dysfunctional can you find a building? How dysfunctional can it be? So he's commenting again about the dysfunction of the whole of the organisation in these country towns. But you, as you'll see, there is a point behind all this. Next paragraph. The only town I saw that differed much from the above consisted of a box bark humpy with a clay chimney and a woman standing at the door throwing out the wash-up water. Why is this town different? And what is a box bark humpy?
A dwelling dug into the ground, with covered, so it's like half it's underground and half it's above ground.
Yep.
And it's box bark is the material that it's made of.
That's right.
Inside, and the chimney goes up the middle to keep all the warmth in, and she's just getting rid of what she doesn't want.
So I wonder why he calls this a town. How can this be a town that's like the other towns, but the only one that's different? Derek, any thoughts?
I mean, it's a typically Australian town. Nobody in the old days, nobody lived right in town except the drunks. They all lived a little bit away.
Yeah.
You know, when they all, and humpy specifically means the classic old single room Australian building.
Yeah.
With a bark roof. The box park is specifically with a bark. On the roof, built in the shingles.
Yeah. I had a thought. I wondered whether it might be an Aboriginal. I thought. I'm not sure. There's no way of telling. No way of telling.
You don't call Aboriginal
residents a humpy.
No, that's specifically Australian. Australian.
Well, it's all specifically Australian.
No, it's post-colonial Australian.
Okay.
Anything from west of Bathurst and that?
Yeah.
Back in the 1800s, you're more likely to find Aboriginals.
Yeah.
Being to the point where...
marginalised.
Yeah, it's the majority of the towns consisted before the white people
yep.
were Aboriginals.
Yeah.
From Bathurst down is one of the largest Aboriginal colonies
yep.
In New South Wales, and it's the second largest in Australia, as in the tribe.
Right. So you wouldn't think that Box Bark Humpy refers to an Aboriginal dwelling?
No, it doesn't.
No.
But
yeah, yeah.
But I was just
you're giving us a pic. You've been giving us a picture of where the Aboriginals were at that time.
Yeah,
yeah, good.
They're not only in the riverbed.
In the riverbed. That's it. They are. That's true. Okay, let's read on. Now, this next paragraph is really interesting. By way of variety, the artist might make a watercolour sketch of a fettler's tent on the line, with a billy hanging over the fire in front, and three fettlers standing around filling their pipes. So by way of variety, so he's talking again, he's the writer talking, but he's writing as if he's a painter. The artist might make a watercolour sketch of a fettler's tent on the line. So there's the fettler's tent on the line. The fettlers are, of course, the people who work on the railway line. With a billy hanging over a fire. And three fettlers standing around filling their pipes. Now, I'm not a very good artist here, but you'll just have to imagine that here are the three fettlers with their pipes, and they're standing around here, around the billy and the tent on top. So by way of variety, so as a writer, he's kind of trying to give us a picture of some other scenes that are part of his vision of the outback of Australia. Next paragraph. Slop sack suits, red faces and old-fashioned flat-brimmed hats with wire around the brims begin to drop into the train on the other side of Bathurst. Notice he doesn't talk about people, but he talks about slop sack suits. A slop sack suit is a very bulky suit that, you know, kind of hangs loose on you. And these are old-fashioned people with flat-brimmed hats. And here and there, a hat with 3 inches of crepe round the crown, which perhaps signifies death in the family at some remote date and perhaps doesn't. Sometimes I believe it only means grease under the band. I notice that when a bushman puts crepe round his hat, he generally leaves it there till the hat wears out or another friend dies. In the latter case, he buys a new piece of crepe. This outward sign of bereavement usually has a jolly red face beneath it. Death is about the only cheerful thing in the bush.
Painless.
It's very...
really bagging it.
He's really bagging it, that's right. He's really bagging it. And it's a humour, but it's a kind of a dark humour. He's making it, he's really bringing out the reality of this place. We crossed the Macquarie, a narrow, muddy gutter with a dog swimming across and three goats interested. That's the Macquarie River. Very matter of fact, the way he describes this, and yet the matter of factness brings out something of its humour. A little further on, we saw the first sundowner. Sundowner, as I explained, the person who arrives at sundown to get food and lodging. He carried a Royal Alfred. Now, Alfred, the Duke of Edinburgh, visited Australia in 1868. And so anybody who wore a big, luxurious pack with a sleeping bag, etc., attached to it, they were carrying a Royal Alfred. He carried a Royal Alfred and had a billy in one hand and a stick in the other. He was dressed in a tail coat turned yellow, a print shirt and a pair of moleskin trousers with big square calico patches on the knees, and his old straw hat was covered with calico. Suddenly he slipped his swag, dropped his billy and ran forward, boldly flourishing the stick. I thought that he was mad and was about to attack the train, but he wasn't. He was only killing a snake. I didn't have time to see whether he cooked the snake or not. Perhaps he only thought of Adam. What does that mean? Perhaps he only thought of Adam. And the snake. Why was he wanting to kill the snake then? The symbol of the devil. But very odd picture this of the sundowner, isn't it? This kind of very quirky picture of someone who's almost crazed by the hot weather. Next paragraph. Somebody told me that the country was very dry on the other side of Nevertire. Nevertire is a fictional name for a country town. Nevertire. Somebody told me that the country was very dry on the other side of Nevertire. It is. It is. That sort of very short sentence making it declaring that, you know, that stating the obvious. I wouldn't like to sit down on it anywhere. The least horrible spot in the bush in a dry season is where the bush isn't, where it's been cleared away and a green crop is trying to grow. They talk of settling people on the land. Better settle in it. I'd rather settle on the water, at least until some gigantic system of irrigation is perfected in the west. So they did talk a lot about settling people in the land. But Henry Lawson is implying that it's not a place to settle, not until water is applied there. So there's he's expressing a strong point of view here about, you know, people who want people to go out and settle on the land. Along about Byrock, we saw the first shearers. They dressed like the unemployed, but differ from that body in their looks of independence. They sat on trucks and wool bales and the fence, watching the train, and hailed Bill and Jim and Tom, and asked how these individuals were getting on. So he's characterizing all the various types in the countryside. Here we came across soft felt hats with straps round the crowns and full bearded faces on them. Also a splendid looking black tracker in a masher uniform, a lady killer uniform, a masher uniform, and a pair of Wellington boots. One or two square cuts and stand-up collars struggled dismally through to the bitter end. I think he's talking here about, you know, the sorts of collars that people from the city might wear, square cuts and stand-up collars, that people have got them on even though they're very dirty and damaged. Often a member of the unemployed starts cheerfully out with a letter from the Government Labour Bureau in his pocket and nothing else. He has an idea that the station where he has the job will be within easy walking distance of Bourke. Perhaps he thinks there'll be a cart or a buggy waiting for him. He travels for a night and day without a bite to eat, and on arrival he finds that the station is 80 or 100 miles away. Then he has to explain matters to a publican and a coach driver. God bless the publicans and the coach driver. God forgive our social system. So it's here talking about people trying to find work and being sent out into the bush to find work and then finding out that they've got to walk 100 k's to the nearest place where there's a job. Native industry was represented at one place along the line by three tiles, a chimney pot, and a length of piping on a slab. Native industry. What is native industry?
Aboriginal settlement.
Is that Aboriginal settlement? And it's a bit ironic, isn't it? He's kind of making a rather underhanded comment there. Native industry was represented at one place by three tiles, a chimney pot, and a length of piping on a slab. Somebody said to me, "You want to go out back, young man, if you want to see the country? You want to get away from the line?" I don't want to. I've been there. You go to the brink of eternity as far as Australia is concerned, and you meet an animated mummy of a swagman who will talk of going out back. Out upon the outback, fiend. Henry Lawson is here kind of really attacking any sentimental views about what the outback is all about. About Byrock, we met the bush liar in all his glory. He was dressed like a bush larrikin. A larrikin is a troublemaker. His name was Jim. He had been to a ball where some blank, Shakespeare, Lawson uses blank when there's a swear word intended. He had been to a ball where some blank had touched his blanky overcoat. The overcoat had a check for 10 quid in the pocket. He didn't seem to feel the loss much. What's 10 quid? He'd been everywhere, including the Gulf country. He still had 3 or 4 sheds to go to. He had telegrams in his pocket from 6 squatters and supers offering him pens on any terms. He didn't give a blank whether he took them or no. He thought at first he had the telegrams on him, but found that he had left them in the pocket of the overcoat aforesaid. He had learned butchering in a day. He was a bit of a scrapper himself and talked a lot about the ring. At the last station where he saw, he gave the super the father of a hiding. The super was a big chap, about 6'3", and had knocked out Paddy somebody in one round. He worked with a man who shore 400 sheep in 9 hours. This is all the bush liar. Here, a quiet-looking bushman in the corner of the carriage grew restless, and presently he opened his mouth and took the liar down in about 3 minutes. What's happened? What's happened? What's the bush liar set himself up to do? And how has this quiet-looking bushman dealt with this bush liar?
Word.
Caught him in his own lies, yeah. Pulled him down from his pompous self-definitions. And the last bit in the story. At 5:30 we saw a long line of camels moving out across the sunset. There's something sneaky about camels. They remind me of turtles and goannas. Somebody said, "Here's Burke!" And off they get off the train. Now, here's a few aspects of Lawson's prose that I've identified. I wonder if you can find any examples of what this use of dialect or idiom. Anybody in England reading this story might have difficulty with some of the expressions. Can you find any examples of dialect or idiom? What is dialect? What is idiom?
Sort of local language.
Dialect is local language used by the working class. Idiom is certain sorts of expressions they might use. For example, he carried a Royal Alfred. Anybody in England or America wouldn't have a clue what a Royal Alfred is, and you actually have to go to a dictionary of Australian colloquialisms or idioms to find out that they used Royal Alfred with reference to Duke Alfred's visit back in 1868. So that's idiom that's grown up. Yes, Derek?
No, I was just wondering, because I thought idiom meant, the kind of language that is spoken by a native speaker.
Correct.
As opposed to, for example, Austrian slang, which is, rather written Hampi and so on and so forth.
Well, dialect is, as you just said there, is the kind of speech that's spoken by people who've grown up in Australia. They've picked up words from various.
Are these even words?
Yawana, that's dialect.
Yeah,
yeah, that's
you
dialect.
I know,
but just the way you read it,
Yawana.
And Lawson is writing it that way because that's the way he wants it heard. He wants it to be heard, and in fact he's giving credibility to the sort of language that's used by the working class people out in the bush, etc.
It's like the what's 10 quid?
Yeah, what's 10 quid?
The way what's spelled is W-A-T.
Yep. Excellent. Outback is a dialect, yeah. And even the bush is a dialect. Even the bush, you don't talk about the bush in England meaning what we mean. That's Australian, a box park humpy, yeah.
What about Masher uniform?
Exactly, another
Sundowner.
Good example. Sundowner, yeah, it's full of it. Now, if you read Australian literature, Australian literature written about 20 years before Lawson wrote, all sounds very much like English literature. And Lawson and Patterson, they began to bring the idiom into the stories, into the language. So other things here, use of ellipsis, leaving things out. It deliberately doesn't say everything. Native industry was represented at one place along the line by three tiles, a chimney pot, and a length of piping on a slab. He doesn't tell them much of a story, he just gives us a few little details, and we fill out the larger point of view that he's representing through that. Creation of mystery. Well, that will become a little more obvious in the next story we look at. But he doesn't tell us the whole story about anything, really. So there's this lurking sense of, well, what's the reality behind how he's describing this world? Simple language, often ironic, often ironic. Draw a wire fence and a few ragged gums and add some scattered sheep running away from the train. Then you'll have the bush all along the New South Wales Western Line. Simple, but ironic, because it's... What does irony mean? What does irony mean?
True, like it's... I like irony.
Not simplicity. It means that something else is meant or intended.
Yeah.
So... It has a double meaning. He's saying that there's hardly anything there, but underneath that, behind that, he's implying that it's a pretty terrible place and that there's not much there to do and there's not much there for anybody. All it is a fence and a train line. What are you going to do out there? Those are all the implications. Okay. So, and the humour, we've seen a lot of this humour is often very dark. Now, if you turn to the next page, the other page that we've got, Henry Lawson's Drifted Back. Now, I just want to play you about 3 minutes of a film that introduces this story, and then we're going to read the story on the page. And then we're going to look at the translation of it into the film. And one of the questions we're going to look at is, does the film add anything to the story?
Communities, and the characters he sought could always be found there. In 1894, Henry returned from tramping around New Zealand and met Bertha Brett. After a short courtship, they married. But the tragic history of Lawson's childhood was to repeat itself. The newlywed Bertha found herself living in a tent in the West Australian gold fields. Her husband struggled to find work, was frequently turning to the bottle to seek relief from his increasing depression. Upon their return to Sydney, Bertha persuaded Lawson to move once more to New Zealand. In 1897, he was employed as a school teacher in a remote Maori school in the South Island of that country. The experiment failed, and a year later, after the birth of their son, they were back in Sydney. His drinking habits grew worse, and in 1898, Lawson spent the first of many spells in a home for alcoholism. Then seemed to regain control of himself. Lawson and his family set off for London in 1900 with their newborn daughter. It was a quest for international recognition. For a short time, it looked like he found it. He was writing prolifically and his works were being published. But the depressive clouds of despair gathered once more for Lawson, and the family returned to Australia in a pathetic condition. This was the beginning of the end. The year was 1902. And at the age of 35, his mind and body racked by alcohol and depression, Lawson attempted suicide by jumping off a cliff. Like his marriage, the attempt failed. He was by now a pathetic, bitter, broken man. In the following years, he was to spend a total of 159 days in jail for non-payment of maintenance to his wife and two children. In these days of darkness, it's certain his downfall would have been complete if it had not been for the gentle care and devotion from an elderly lady, Mrs. Byers, who had befriended him. She was to feed and care for him for the rest of his life. Despite his personal misfortunes, he continued writing, mainly poetry. But his use of alcohol as a refuge continued, and in 1908, he was admitted several times to a mental hospital for treatment. In the following years, Lawson's flame of creation was reduced to only a flicker. He used his verse to express his tangled emotions. He was tormented by regret, disappointment, and lost opportunities, and a longing to revisit the past. His writing became a mirror of himself.
Okay, this is where this story starts. So we're going to look at that story when we come back from our coffee. Still playing. Thank you. How am I going to kill it? That's it. Killed it. So the point of the exercise is we're going to look at this story as another example, but perhaps an even more focused, minimalist example of the way that Henry Lawson uses language so effectively to kind of tell a much bigger story than is actually on the page. And there's some questions at the end of the story here that we're going to look at. But what the last question is, what are some of the features of the language of drama that the film version adds to the written text? So what I'm trying to get at there is, when we read the story, we will read the text, we'll make some assumptions and discussions about the themes and the way the language is used. But when somebody turns that into a film, in fact turns a story into a dramatic presentation, all those additional aspects of the language of drama that I mentioned last week, like lighting, sound, setting, casting, all those other elements come into play. And then there's a question. Does the use of drama change the original text in some way or other? When we come next in the fortnight to start working on that Shakespeare text, how does the way that we use the language bring certain aspects of it to light? And so that's the direction we're moving. So let's have a look at this story and then we'll break for coffee. It's called Drifted Back, and the film that we just watched there talked about the way towards the end of Lawson's life, often his stories and poems kind of went back to earlier memories. Yes, Mike?
So his life wasn't glamorous or prestigious.
His life was far from glamorous.
His legacy was left for his words.
His legacy was left for his words. He died a pauper, an alcoholic, and a week after he died, there was, and you'll see it, I'll show you the film here, there was a national burial for him in the streets of Sydney. Hundreds of thousands of people came out for his funeral, and his statue stands there near the art gallery. We'll go next week, we'll go down and have a look at the statue.
So he wasn't really recognised or acknowledged during his time?
Not really.
And why was he recognised after his death?
Well,
like all great artists,
yeah,
their work becomes more valuable once they die.
Something of what he wrote was valued. There was a sort of a real sense of tragedy that someone...
I was going to say that.
It is tragic. He actually went to London, and when we're in the art gallery next week, we'll see a portrait of him done by one of Australia's great portrait painters the day before he went to London, dressed in a suit, and like the beginning of a fantastic career. But he came back and everything collapsed. And you know, you can ask, well, why did it collapse? What was it? And people say it was his background. He was born on the gold fields. He didn't have an emotional stability.
Because he drank.
That's the biggest thing. That's the biggest thing that pulled him down. And it's really sad to see somebody who can write with such intelligence and understanding destroy themselves at the same time.
He was suffering from depression.
He had something to do.
But look at Amy Lady. I mean, a lot of them have suffered from depression.
Exactly.
And I don't know
that's
if
right.
It's the reverse of the creativity or something.
Well, it might be.
You're more creative when you're in an emotional state.
Well, they sometimes say, that's right, they sometimes say that people who are creative, artists, poets, writers, they see more than most people. They're not cut off in the same way. So they see the pain in themselves and around them more than others. and in a way that nurtures their creativity, but it also destroys it. But it's not true of everybody. It's not necessarily true of all creative artists. Okay, let's go. The stranger walked into the corner grocery with the air of one who had come back after many years to see someone who would be glad to see him. He shed his swag and stood it by the wall with great deliberation. Then he rested his elbow on the counter, stroked his beard, and grinned quizzically at the shopman, who smiled back presently in a puzzled way. "Good afternoon," said the grocer. "Good afternoon." "Nice day," said the grocer. "Nice day." "Anything I can do for you?" "Yes." "Tell the old man there's a chap wants to speak to him for a minute." "Old man? What old man?" "Hake, of course. Old Ben Hake. Ain't he in?" The grocer smiled. "Hake ain't here now. I'm here." "How's that?" "Why, he sold out to me 10 years ago." "Well, I suppose I'll find him somewhere about town." "I don't think you will. He left the colonies when he sold out. He's dead now." "Dead? Old Ben Hake?" "Yes. You knew him then?" The stranger seemed to have lost a great deal of his assurance. He turned his side to the counter, hooked his elbow on it, and gazed out through the door along Sunset Track. "You can give me 1/2 pound of nail rod," he said in a quiet tone. "I suppose young Hake is in town?" "No, the whole family went away. I think there's one of the sons in business in Sydney now." "I suppose the McLaughlins are here yet?" "No, they are not. The old people died about 5 years ago. The sons are in Queensland, I think. And both the girls are married and in Sydney." "Ah, well, I see you've got the railway here now." "Oh, yes, 6 years. Times has changed a lot." "They are. I suppose you can tell me where I'll find old Jimmy Nowlett." Jimmy Nowlett. I never heard of the name. What was he?" "Oh, he was a bullock driver. Used to carry from the mountains before the railway was made." "Before my time, perhaps. There's no one of that name round here now." "Ah, well, I don't suppose you know the Duggins?" "Yes, I did. The old man's dead too, and the family's gone away, Lord knows where. They weren't much lost to all accounts. The sons got into trouble, I believe, went to the bad. They had a bad name here." "Did they? Well, they had good hearts. At least old Malachi Duggan and the eldest son had. You can give me a couple of pounds of sugar?" "Right. I suppose it's a long time since you were here last." 15 years. "Indeed. Yes, I don't suppose I remind you of anyone you know round here?" "No," said the grocer with a smile. I can't say you do." "Ah, well, I suppose I'll find the Wilds still living in the same place." "The Wilds? Well, no. The old man is dead too, and where's Jim? He ain't dead." "No, he's married and settled down in Sydney." "Can you," said the stranger hesitatingly, "did you I suppose you knew Mary. Mary Wilde. Mary, said the grocer smilingly. That was my wife's maiden name. Would you like to see her? No, no. She might remember me. He reached hastily for his swag and shouldered it. Well, I must be getting on. I suppose you'll camp here over Christmas. No, there's nothing to stop here for. I'll push on. I did intend to have a Christmas here. In fact, I came a long way out of my road a purpose. I meant to have just one more Christmas with old Ben Hake and the rest of the boys. But I didn't know as they'd moved on so far west. The old bush school is dying out. There was a smile in his eyes, but his bearded lips twitched a little. Things is changed. The old houses is pretty much the same. And the old signs want touching up and painting just as bad as ever. And there's that old paling fence that me and Ben Hake and Jimmy Nowlett put up 20 years ago. I've tramped and travelled long ways since then. But things is changed. At least people is. Well, I must be going. There's nothing to keep me here. I'll push on and get into my track again. It's cooler travelling in the night. Yes, it's been pretty hot today. Good day. Merry Christmas. Eh? What? Oh yes, same to you. So long. Good day. Drifted out and away along Sunset Track. So three questions for when we come back after coffee. What are some of the features of Lawson's language? How has he helped to create an Australian idiom? What does this story tell us about the experience of the stranger? Can you identify some of the themes in this story? What are some of the features of the language of drama that the film version adds? And we'll do that question after we look at the film. We come back first and we'll discuss those first three questions to begin with. Coffee time. It's a big place, isn't it? The hall up there, the Great Hall at Newcastle Uni. Is that where the graduation was held?
No.
It wasn't? Oh, right.
It's held down in the centre of town.
Oh, right. Okay. Wonder why they did that.
Civic.
Okay. Was this just the PhDs, was it?
Okay. Yeah.
Fantastic. We don't need that much rain.
It's all rains too much. Oh, it's too hot.
Exactly.
Oh, it's, you know, like, I mean,
there's
a
complaining
down.
That
it's
not enough.
Happy.
Oh, exactly.
No, like,
not enough, too much.
Thank you for the rain.
Too hot or too cold? It's such a brilliant dude. And I had it at all of you.
Yeah.
I just, you know, I had this feeling before it was done again.
Not today, it's a good one, that one.
It's good to have such an extended look at it. Especially Australian one, too.
Yeah. Oh, he's a master of short stories. Captures the whole generation, the whole era. Short story.
Yeah, it's amazing. I wonder how many characters there are all up.
Yeah, that's right. But the book of prose is called Joe Wilson's Mates. So there's hundreds of them, hundreds of characters.
When it's your turn,
have you read any more of Lawson before this?
No, but it just reminds me of, like, you know, people always ask how the game is through the great wine, or how's this guy going?
That's right, that's right.
Where's he at?
That's right. That's it, exactly. How's that bloke, and what's that? In this case, they've all died. Oh, God, they've all died. I better get back onto the track.
You'll struggle to use signposts to get anywhere. And in the country, it's even worse. People just assume you've been there before. Or just keep going, you know.
Yeah.
So that social connection for him is just they've all gone.
They've all gone.
And he's embarrassed about not wanting to meet the man. Why?
And why is that? That's a real mystery.
Well,
why is
we
it?
Never know.
We never know.
Maybe he had a crush on her. And maybe went away, and then you sort of, oh my God, she's married this guy. I don't want to go through the embarrassment of why it took off.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was an interesting little. Oh no, I don't want to meet Mary.
Why
she
not?
Won't
she's
remember.
The only person here that you remember still
she
alive.
She won't remember what you did. You
might.
Don't want to know what Mary and I did.
The dry Australian sophistication.
He's a sick man now, isn't he?
Still writing
poems.
Well, I don't know. I think,
but
you know,
he,
as you get older and you think that death is closing in, we somehow must revisit the past.
He's in London. He's in London now.
Oh, yeah.
He's had 5 extra years, he says. Keep on 5 years.
Okay.
There's a lot of there's a Henry Lawson Society, isn't there, that meets.
I don't know, but I'm sure
people
there is.
People get together and read. Like, there's a few. I've met a few people in my working room going over the years, older guys in parishes and stuff, and they recite. They get together in groups. They have competitions, like national competitions.
Dress up.
Well, I don't know about the dress up, but they get together and recite, and then they write stuff along that vein.
Yeah.
It's
There was a fantastic, about 10 years ago, there was a fantastic drama presentation. Somebody was going all around Australia doing readings of Henry Lawson as Henry Lawson.
Oh,
wow.
It'd be nice if that came back one day.
Yeah, well, the way the economy's going, it's probably good right now. I'm sorry,
that's right.
so about it.
Yeah.
There's more here.
Elevated, exalted. Well, I always say to my students, you know, it's tragic that Banjo Paterson became so financially well off as a result of his writing, and Lawson just, you know, didn't. And the reason is because Lawson was telling the truth and Paterson was telling a load of lies. But people like to hear the lies rather than the truth.
He got away with it.
That's right. And of course, Lawson and Paterson, if we had more
Paterson's
time.
Curse.
That's it. We'd look at the feud they had in the Bulletin. Lawson was sort of writing poems about the outback, saying how the outback was not your vision of sunlit plains extended. And you, Paterson, you see the bush as a kind of a glorified world for heroes, but you only see the bush on the back of a horse. And you're a lawyer with a lawyer's hat on. You don't see the real thing. So there was a back and forth between the two of them in the Bulletin.
Sort of like boutique traveller.
That's right, a boutique traveller, a good way of putting it, yeah.
I've been to the Blue Mountains, I know what the country's like.
I was there once.